So I'd like to move to introduce Danny Dorling, who's our first speaker. So we're really delighted that Danny's come to speak to us today. Danny is a professor of human geography at the University of Oxford. You might also note he has the shortest biography in our biography section, and I think the size of his biography is in inverse proportion to the amount of work that he's done. He has a lovely website, dannydorling.org, if you want to be looking up for reading more about the work that Danny's done. But certainly for me, I've always found Danny's work very challenging and thought-provoking, and he is one of those people who literally get you to see the world in a different way through the maps that he produces. And I particularly think of Danny's population cartograms, which is a different way of envisaging space. And maybe in the same way that some of the 18th century political cartoons made you see the political world in a different way. And Danny's work, I think, is that same sort of change of vision and perspective. So we're very much looking forward to your talk, Danny. And if you'd like to come up, thank you.
Thank you very much for that, and thank you for inviting me. I'm going to rattle through about 25 slides. I'm going to try and do it quickly because I'm most interested in what questions you might have to ask. And I'm largely going to show my work, which is going to be a bit of a disappointment, because increasingly over the years I've worked with other people who've been very good at looking at very big data. But that stuff has largely been their work. I want to show you some of the things that I've been doing recently. This is one of the first maps I produced back in 1989-1990. There were over 100,000 dots there. I'm afraid the photograph isn't very good. Back then, on a computer screen, we could only see about a 20th of that kind of image. You had to print it out before you could see it. Each one of those is an enumeration district. There are about 500 people in an enumeration district, and it's coloured by the social class that's dominant in each area. Blue, professional, red for those who are supervised. One thing that intrigues me at the moment is how we got from that to this. This is the Brexit vote, showing you both which areas were majority leave. The majority leave areas are blue, and then also showing you the proportions. The Brexit vote is still being analysed and debated in social science. It's a fascinating thing. It can be linked to health. The connections between different areas are one of the most fascinating things going on at the moment, and I'll show you some of those connections in a minute. Essentially, life's winners voted to remain, to keep things as they are. Life's losers were more likely to vote to leave, but it wasn't the absolute losers. Apart from a few places on the East Coast, the areas of the country which voted most to leave were in England, by deprivation deciles 4, 5, 6 and 7. Middle England. It's places that you might not think as poor, but if you were a Conservative voter, you would, because it's where the poorest Conservative voters live. And it's that kind of thing that interests me. We could already begin to see the start of spatial polarisation when we looked at change between the 71 and 81 censuses. You can hardly see it there, because it was only just starting back at the end of the 70s and starts of the 80s. I'm afraid that's the last big data slide I'm going to show you, which has over 100,000, because what I've been doing as I've gone through my career is aggregating, getting smaller and smaller. And in a few minutes, I'm going to be showing you graphs, not with three data points, haven't yet gone to that, but graphs which actually only have about 10 data points, but I think still tell us quite a lot. This map was produced by Ben Hennig. If you want to see incredibly detailed maps of the world stretched out in this kind of way, just Google Views of the World, which is Ben's website, and you'll see that there. These are not two areas for Europe. It's a population cartogram. I get fairly flippant over time. How many of you have not seen a population cartogram before? Good, some honesty, a couple of people. Okay, but this is partly how the world's changed over the last 30 years. 30 years ago, you had to spend ages explaining this. Areas made proportional to people. So London is big because London has a lot of people. The areas are shaded according to the proportion of people who are born in another country, using the Eurostat data from 2014, the most recent that we had. The areas, which are yellow, under 5% of people are born in another country. The north of England is very similar to Eastern Europe in terms of that. There are remarkably few immigrants. The immigrants are concentrated in Northern Ireland and London, which is why London voted Remain. It wasn't just about winning, it's all about being integrated. The fewer immigrants you have, the less likely you were to vote to Remain, the more worried you were about immigrants. In the middle of Europe, you've got Switzerland, the area of highest immigration, but the second biggest cluster is down in Spain. And a large proportion of those immigrants are immigrants. And if you're interested in population health in the future, I think it's worth thinking what will happen when the elderly English in Spain begin to return when they can't afford the private healthcare fees that they might have to pay in Spain. Little bits of evidence about health and the vote. The best evidence you actually see is the Trump vote in the United States and the correlation of the Trump vote by county. There are 3,000 counties in the US, was found to be stronger with health measures than anything else. The Economist did the analysis. They had no axe to grind. I haven't got the graph to show you, but essentially better off people in those areas of the US which were going downwards in terms of health were more likely to switch the Republicans and vote Trump. This is similar to the geography of Brexit. Better off people, in other words, conservative voters, in poorer parts of the country that were going downhill were more likely to vote out. These graphs come from the Understanding Society data. They're of the proportion of people who say they're completely satisfied with their health, somewhat satisfied, mostly, and so on. And you can see the population telling us in 2011, 12, and 13 that they were increasingly dissatisfied with their health. This is one of the components of David Cameron's happiness index. I think it's the most important component, what people say about their health. There was a slight change to how the data was collected between two of the years, but it really doesn't matter. The population of Britain was saying that something was going wrong as far as they're concerned, and we tended to ignore that. We are very bad at comparing ourselves with other countries. I'm going to show you quite a few comparisons of other countries in a minute. This is public spending as a proportion of GDP over time. The big spike in the middle is making sure the cash points keep going. That was the global bailout of banks. Ireland did the biggest bailout of all, following our advice. Our advice wasn't very good, I think. But that's why you've got that enormous spike in the middle. The important thing is to see that towards the end, these are the projections from the IMF, we're heading towards just 36% of GDP being spent on public services in this country. If you want to know why things are going wrong, I think this graph tells you it more than anything else I can produce. I walked here from the very nice hotel that they put me up in last night, past parents and nannies taking their children in little blazers with little crests to various prep schools in Kensington. The majority of schools in Kensington are private schools. The majority of hospitals in Kensington are private hospitals. And you may say Kensington or London is different, but it's actually this country that is different and choosing to become increasingly different. The Labour manifesto of June this year, the proposals would have moved that black thick line up one percentage point. That was the ridiculous spending promises that were being made. We weren't talking about making us like France or like Finland or like Germany. That's the kind of game that we play. We're playing around in that kind of a territory, and it matters for health. Okay, here's some of the work I've been doing recently, and I'm showing this because I really want to know if this kind of thing is of use. I'm going to show it you for health in a minute, but I'm going to start off with polling data. Polling data is now big data. On average, we get a poll a day. There are more polls as you come up to an election, but on average, it's a poll a day. So you can aggregate it. And it's when you aggregate this kind of data that you begin to see patterns. Now, let me try and explain this graph. What the graph is showing is the proportion of the population on the y-axis who said that if there's a general election tomorrow, they would vote UKIP or for the referendum party in 97, BNP, English Democrats, and so on. So it's the British far-right parties. And on the x-axis, you've got the change in the year in that proportion. It begins in 1997 down here when James Goldsmith spent an enormous amount of money putting candidates up all over the country and got himself about, if I look carefully, just over 1% of the vote. It then goes down to almost zero in 98, goes up to a little peak in 2004, goes down again, comes across, that means it's rising, goes up to a peak in 2009, that was a European election, comes down again, and then this absolutely enormous rise. When you get an enormous rise, because the x-axis is showing you change, the thing zooms off to the side. So this kind of graph is very good at highlighting changes. I really want to know if anybody has seen this before. Please come up to me at coffee and just tell me. There are phase diagrams, but they're a different kind of thing. My interpretation of this, oh, by the way, it's now back down to 1%. It's completely collapsed again. My interpretation of this particular spiral, and I'm only going to show you one more of these, I've drawn hundreds of them for political parties, is that there hasn't been a steadily growing support for right-wing political parties in Britain over time. What there has been are people who have boosted up the support at particular points in time when there are elections or referendum, when they want the population to vote in that way. When you look at other parties, you don't see this kind of thing at all. The Conservatives in the 80s and 90s were quite good at becoming more popular just before an election and were always unpopular between elections. Labour were very good at doing the opposite. That's how you lose. But this suggests to me that the sentiment was arranged in some way, bought with money, tabloid newspapers, other things. If it can rise and fall like that, you're not looking at some heartfelt kind of slow rise of the British population. And this is the second of these graphs. This is the Labour vote. From 2015 every month to the 1st of June 2017. Now you have to take my word for this. This has never happened in polling history of all the polls in Britain before. This kind of thing is interesting. In May 2015, when Ed Miliband was trying to become Prime Minister, Labour on 33% and heading downwards. The polls then skittled around a bit. There was a leadership election. A man called Jeremy became leader. They begin to plummet down. There's another leadership election. A man called Jeremy still manages to be leader. And Labour get themselves all the way down to 24% of the vote. Historic low. Unbelievable. You can never recover from that. That's what you're told. Theresa May was out walking and her advisers had told her you absolutely have to call a general election. You'd be stupid not to in these circumstances. And given all the data that they had to date, they were completely right. Because there was no way in which this kind of thing could actually happen. And then it happened. If you average the polls are very messy individually because the population didn't know really how it felt. It wasn't that the pollsters didn't know what they were doing. The thing they were trying to measure was difficult because it was a moving object. But if you average the polls, in 1 month, there was a 6-point increase. And then the next month, there was a 5-point increase. The increase actually carried on right up to 39% by polling day, and we got a hung parliament. The little red graph here is the conventional measure of swing. The swing to the election in June of this year was the largest swing to Labour that has been at any time since 1945. The 45 swing was a swing over 10 years since the 35 election. Something remarkable happening, and you can't see it's remarkable unless you aggregate the big data. People often say that the polls were inaccurate, they're biased, they got it wrong. In one way, they didn't. In one way, they are absolutely spot on. The way in which the polls in Britain are spot on is if you realise that if you ask somebody, I could ask all of you, how would you vote if there was an election tomorrow? The question you will actually answer is, how would you have voted had there been an election 6 weeks ago? Because you know the answer to that. The polls are 6 weeks lagged. They hit the election results 6 weeks after the election. Because we don't know how we would vote in an election tomorrow. We think we know, but in fact many people don't actually go to bother to vote who say they would. If you begin to interpret that about the data, you can see the polls as a much more useful thing than they are otherwise. So I hope you've got the idea of the graph. On the y-axis, you've got the number you're measuring, just one number, 36% of the vote. That's my only data, a single number. And on the x-axis, you've got how fast is that number moving, and you turn it into a two-dimensional space. Health. You may be relieved we're going to go back to health for a bit and so on. And this is where we get to the small number of numbers. Life expectancy in the United Kingdom. In 1993, average for men and women, Eurostat data was around about 76. It was rising by about 0.4 of a year back in 93. Rises in 94, but not so fast. Rises in 95. Rising quite steadily. 0.2, 0.3 of a year, if you get it. On the x-axis, it's a change. On the y-axis, it's a level. It's just life expectancy. Till we get to 2009-10, where we've got an expectancy just over under 81 years. And then it begins to slow down dramatically. You can see it's skedaddling right across the graph. Till we get to actual falls in life expectancy, 2014, 2015, by the data that Eurostat have. So this is a way of taking simply a small set of numbers, looking at the change between those numbers, and trying to see if it shows us something. The contrast, of course, is Finland. Finland carries on increasing its life expectancy at around about a fifth of a year every year. So whatever happened in the United Kingdom, it's not some global pandemic that's happened everywhere. The UK, for women, has lower life expectancy than 19 other European countries. The only major country where we do slightly better is Denmark, because the Danes did a great service to the world and smoked far too much. And show you can have a lovely country where you're all nice to each other and you do everything else right, but I'm afraid you can't have cigarettes. But other than Finland, we're in a bad state at the moment in Britain. There's a report coming out tomorrow. I saw the press release last night in BMJ Open. I've got nothing to do with it, but it looks like a very serious study claiming that between 2010 and 2017, an additional 120,000 people died prematurely in Britain than would be expected to die. And that report says not only have they died earlier, so it's actually turning into absolute numbers, that's skedaddling across, but it can attribute those deaths to the cuts in public services and the austerity of the country. So I'm obviously interested in this, if you know what I look at, but it's got nothing to do with me. The key thing about science is when different people end up producing very similar results, then you begin to work out something is happening. But what I'm going to show you next, the next four slides, is data for other European countries, because it isn't as simple as just being the cuts in Britain. Nobody is as bad as us. that has to be said. We actually have infant mortality rising. Actually, there is somebody worse than us. It's the United States. It's always United States. But, you know, if you're ever feeling too depressed about this country, just look at stats for the United States. Nobody is doing as bad as us. But something went on in Germany. Again, I do not, honestly, this is not influenza. Influenza cannot have this size of result. I suspect it's a bit of austerity. I can't imagine that you create a home for 1 million Syrian refugees and that has no effect. Normally, of course, when you let people in, your life expectancy rises faster because migrants are healthy. The only age group in Britain where mortality fell in that year 2005, which was our worst year, 2015, the only age group was the 25 to 29-year-olds, which is the only age group of 60,000 net immigrants. We've been importing young, healthy Europeans that somebody else has paid for their education over here, and it's actually been boosting our life expectancy. And we've been sending our old overseas to die in somebody else's country. But anyway. And amazingly, we think this is a bad deal. This country is about to learn a hell of a lot about itself very, very quickly. But still, to be fair, you're comparing Germany and Norway. Norway's managing to do well. Germany isn't. Really small data. Aggregated data just looked at in a different way. Spain. We know about lots of things going wrong in Spain. Incidentally, if you rank the big countries of the world by inequality, the US is the worst and they've had Trump. We're the next of the very big countries and we've done Brexit. And as Spain, you may not realise, is the next most unequal. And had the Spanish government done anything silly recently? I won't tell you which is next, but it would be quite nice for me if it carries on. Sweden, not as good as the other Scandinavian countries, but still no actual falls. So it's these contrasts between countries in Europe I think are fascinating. France and Denmark. Young Danes have stopped smoking. Incredible change. Denmark, although, again, you're seeing some stalling in 2015, you're not seeing the falls. I haven't worked out where or how to publish these graphs yet. I'm kind of waiting for another year's data because when these kind of things happen, you're kind of wondering what is 2016 going to show. Italy and the Netherlands. And I think it's economics. I think it's different ways of dealing with things. If we could go back, and we don't have enough time, but if we could go back to that slide of public spending, when the global economic crash happened, what they did in the Netherlands, what they did in Finland, is increase taxation and increase the percentage of GDP spent on public services, so you didn't have cuts even if your GDP fell. Can you imagine doing that? We've done the opposite. Our GDP's fallen, and we've reduced the proportion of GDP that we spend on public services. We're an odd country. Inequality is a thing that I've been increasingly concentrating on. This is the take of the 1% over time. The best off 10%, 1%, used to take a fifth of all income. We're not as bad as that now, but we're back to 1936. It feels normal to us, but it's not normal. We're back to the kind of upstairs, downstairs world that we once were, but something interesting is happening recently. The bottom graph is after tax. The top graph is before tax and how much the 1% take. More big data. It's very hard to get historical data, but it's quite important because people often say, oh, the last century was just strange, and in general you have great inequality. Piketty says this. It's not true as far as we can tell from long-term data. The American colonies were remarkably equal way back in the 1770s. Netherlands was unequal. It was the richest country in the world before England became the richest country in the world. The Netherlands is now remarkably equal. That bottom point for the UK, 1968, is when I was born. It probably explains some of why I'm waffling on to you like I am. I was born at the most equal time. I went to school at the most equal time this country has ever been. These things can change and change quite rapidly. This is the league table from 2010. for inequality for the richest 25 countries of the world with at least 2 million people. It's the average income of the best off 10th compared to the worst off 10th. And even in Japan, which I'm fairly sure is the most equal of these countries, the best off 10th are still getting 4.5 times more than the worst off 10th. After Japan, the Scandinavian countries line up very neatly, but then Germany, which we need to look at a lot more, Austria, Slovenia, South Korea, Denmark, Belgium, Switzerland, is an averagely unequal country in Europe. France, the Netherlands, Ireland, Canada, Greece, Spain, Italy, New Zealand, Australia, Israel. So we've got to go above Israel for inequality. And then we get to us. Currently, our 10%, our top 10%, are taking 28% of all income. The top 10% are not a happy bunch, because even though they're taking 28% of all income, the bottom 9/10 of I'm going to say us, because if your household income is over 40,000, 45,000, well, I won't do a show of hands because we're still too embarrassed about it all. If your household income is over 40,000, 45,000, you're in that top 10%. But 9/10 of that top 10% are only taking 14% of all income. The other 14% is taken by the best off 1%. It's the 1% that drive this. But that best off 1% are not a happy bunch, because the bottom half of that 1% feel that they are hard done by. These are people getting less than £300,000 a year. Why are you hard done by if you're on less than £300,000 a year? Because you can't afford to live in Kensington and walk your child with a nice little blazer to that school. It's not enough money. You've got to be in the top half. Portugal has now dropped down out of that league because of the crash. The US is still above us. Singapore's a fascinating little laboratory for what happens if you are extremely unequal. The 2015 data is shown in the table. I spend my life worrying about quality of data and whether this is true or not, but the data is getting better and better, and I'm fairly sure it's fairly good. We get different stories about what's happening in the country. Some people like to say, we've been becoming more equal since 1990, what are you worrying about? The bottom graph shows you that. And because you're data nerds, I can tell you what the bottom graph is. The bottom graph is the ratio of the median income of the top quintile to the median income of the bottom quintile. So it ignores the top 10%, and it ignores entirely the bottom 10%. And it's completely true. For that particular measure of inequality, it maxed when Margaret Thatcher resigned in 1990, and it's been gradually going down. Sometime after 2012, the income of the 1%, which is what's driven the increased income, mainly the 10%, may have also gone down. But they got up to about taking a sixth of all income in the country and paying a third of all income tax. The distributions are fascinating. I used to get annoyed about the different measures, Gini ratios, 1% and so on. But in fact, they all tell a story when you put them together. And they happen to have coincided at the moment. So we are the European country in which the 1% take the most. We are now the European country in which the ratio of the best off 10% to the worst off 10% is the highest. And by the Gini coefficient, which economists love for some reason, we are now the most unequal country in Europe by the Gini coefficient. We've just beaten Estonia again. Try to imagine, when it comes to health consequences, if you were the country that had the highest rate of smoking, would you worry about it? Well, the Danes didn't for quite a long time. We still have to learn that this incredible amount of economic inequality is highly problematic, and it's problematic for people at the top. What's happening at the very top? Really interesting things. Here's near the top of the top. 3rd of August this year, the High Pay Centre, which monitors top salaries, reported that the average CEO in the country had taken a fall in income of around about £1 million. There were no street parties. I almost went out and had a look on my street, because I've been doing this for 30 years and this is the first fall in my lifetime. Almost no reaction. The Guardian picked it up. It's quite incredible, but it's partly It's partly because people say, well, it's still far too high. And that's what happened before in the 1920s and 30s when inequalities fell. This has also happened a year earlier in the States, we think. It's very hard. You know why it's hard. It's Paradise Papers. That's why it's quite hard to know what's really going on. Now, I wonder how many of you, your heart sinks when you see people do this, but I do this. This kind of graphing began with the spirit level. The spirit level looked at just 13 things. There have been many more since. If we had 20 planets, we could get an R squared and we could do some decent stats, but we don't. We only have one planet Earth. We only have 25-odd rich countries, so we just have the data to plot. But what I'm showing you here is inequality along the bottom. And for all the countries for which there is data in the global data set, I'm showing you the carbon footprint as measured in 2012, and I've taken the states of the United States and split them all up. So you can begin to see some kind of relationship between how much we pollute and how unequal we are. This matters very much politically if you're worried about burning up a planet, because it suggests that you cannot easily get people's consumption levels down and their behaviour to be more environmentally sensible while you're paying some people very much more than other people. The second graph there is intellectual property rights. People often say that unequal countries are more innovative. Unfortunately, the data says the opposite. Back to health again. This was the only thing we could produce about 5 or 10 years ago. It's very, very clunky. You can see the problem with having the United States as one unit. The numbers were rounded to one. The exceptions on these graphs are always fascinating, by the way. New Zealand has a particular problem, which it is trying to address with how it treats the people who got there 800 years ago rather than the people who got there 150 years ago. Singapore, I said, was this amazing laboratory. How does Singapore do it? Having one of the lowest infant mortality rates in the world while having some of the greatest equality. And the lovely thing about these graphs is you then zoom in on the places on the edge and try and work out, is the data wrong? What's going on? Singapore's got very good hospitals, but that's not why Singapore has the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. If you want the lowest mortality rate in the world in a rich country that's unequal, pregnancy test 100,000 women every 3 months. 100,000 women are pregnancy tested in Singapore every 3 months, and if they're pregnant, they have to leave because they are the Filipino maids. That is how to get infant mortality really low. You can imagine it for this country. Empire 2.0, no free movement of labour. You can come in from Europe and work here, but you can't have a child here. We'll send you back guest labourers. It's not going to work for the UK, because the UK isn't a small island conveniently located at exactly the right point for global trade at the moment. And here's the same graph, but with better data and the United States split up. And it's the most unequal states in which infant mortality is highest and is rising. And why is infant mortality rising in places like Mississippi and Texas? Because in the last few years, they've closed 3/4 of the maternity units for people. I mean, some of this is just so strikingly obvious. And there's life expectancy. Again, for the richest countries of the world, with Japan at the top, and the United States giving us that kind of cascade down to 75 for Mississippi. This needs unravelling. Infant mortality is easier in a way because it is, you know, in the last year and, you know, gestation. Life expectancy, you're looking at what's happened over the whole course of people's lives. So somebody needs to do some decent work where they look at what was the country like each decade that people were alive, how can you predict the result. In the Spirit Level book, life expectancy correlation with inequality was the weakest of all 13 correlations that they had. Correlation is not causation, but it's neither coincidence. I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to go really, really fast. You'll just have to read that. I'm going to show you two more graphs and then come to a conclusion. This is a graph of ability in exams internationally for children aged 15, inequality along the bottom, ability at maths along the side. Singapore, again, providing an exception, doesn't mean they're great at maths, it means they make their 15-year-olds get really high scores at a particular test. This is the same maths test done to adults up to age 24. So we teach maths badly, and we teach it in a way that means you don't remember it later. Why do we do that? Because we're an unequal country and it really matters to get an A rather than actually learn maths. My students at Oxford don't like this very much when I tell them that their A stars don't mean that they're great. I know there's an irony about talking about all this small data in a conference about big data, but this small data is highlighting things which now need to be looked at with the detailed data. Right. There have been changes in the last few years, social changes that have been faster than in the whole of my career. There are connections between those who say economic inequality is fine, don't worry about it, and they're saying people are actually sponsored by tobacco companies that say that smoking is fine. And my last slide. The danger with big data is that if you don't see the big picture that small data gives you, you can begin to blame the victims. You can begin to say, if only they were less feckless, if only they ate better, if only they tried a bit harder. It's when you zoom out and see the big data that you can see that if you're living in Mississippi, you have to try so much harder than if you're living in Norway and you're at the same point in society. And so if I was making recommendations of the things that you need to look at, well, when that paper comes out tomorrow, I can't believe it will not get press coverage, saying in effect that the government are responsible for 120,000 deaths. That's one little dot in every one of those enumeration districts I showed you at the start. Somebody needs to begin to zoom in and look at that and work out who was it, why was it. It may not be the poorest. Most of the deaths have been of very elderly people, just dying a few years earlier than they would have otherwise died. Now, to make it to 85, you had to be fairly well off on average. So there are fascinating things to look at. We're on 9:41 and we've only got 4 minutes left, so I'm going to stop now. Please think of any questions, and thank you very much. We've got a mic, I think.
I've got a microphone here. Thank you very much, Danny. That was, as expected, a very fascinating and challenging talk. While we're waiting for questions, I have got one to ask you, which is, given the inequalities that you've shown that are increasing over time, what do you make of the ONS Life Satisfaction Survey that was widely reported in the press this week, saying we're happier after Brexit?
The seven out of ten thing. I need to look at it. If you look at crude life satisfaction, this is, well, let's ask, how many of you are happy 7 out of 10 at the moment? Yeah, it's a normal answer. Any 8s? I won't ask you why. Particularly good conference dinner? Okay. When people are asked this very simple question on a scale from 1 to 10, how happy are you? The happiest people are Americans. And the most unhappy people are Japanese and Germans and French. They head towards 5 out of 10 because they're better at maths. You get it? The rational answer is 5 out of 10. That's what you should be. Richard Wilkinson has a much better explanation of this, and it goes into how you have to be positive-minded in an unequal place to get through life. You have to tell yourself it's great. My suspicion about the recent ONS one is partly we had a plummeting, but also there is this kind of get-a-grip thing. In that happiness index that David Cameron commissioned in 2010, it bungs together 32 statistics. I just take out the health ones because as you get older, you begin to realise that the most important thing in life is health and the health of those you love, and everything else pales into insignificance. But I do need to look at it. I hope that's given you enough time. time to think of a question. Criticism?
That's great. Are there any other questions?
Brandon Parks, Imperial. On your slide with public spending by country, quite near the beginning, the US, how does the health spending in the US affect that? Because a lot of that is private spending, isn't it?
Yes, that's the private spending of the US obviously isn't in there, and it's the biggest health spender in the world.
Yeah.
The public health spending is in there, and the public health spending is actually quite large in the United States. It has the most inefficient health system in the world. So the US is that little dotted line at 35. Sadly, the reason why it's at 35 and not below Ireland is that all the military spending is in there. So if you actually think about that, these countries at the top, which are spending on services, don't tend to have massive armies and aircraft carriers in the South China Sea. Whereas the United States not only publicly spends very lowly, but it's spending a lot of its money on the military-industrial complex. We're quite bad at that as well. It's not very popular to say, but we don't need to be spending as much money on the military as we are, except we kind of feel we need to. I'll give you one other way. There's two other ways in which the US and UK rank first and second. One is in the arms trade. The US is the biggest arms trader. We're the second biggest in the world. The other is Olympic medals. US first, we second. And again, if you look at spending, we actually paid for them. And the irony of the Olympic medals is that the United States is the most obese and unfit country in the rich world. And in Europe, we are the most obese. But we got more Olympic medals, so it's all okay. Is there one last question? There's one at the back.
Thanks very much. That was an absolutely fascinating presentation. Just one question. I noticed there were two countries missing from the data, or at least I think they were missing. I don't recall seeing any. One is Russia and the other is China. And I think both of these countries have had interesting political changes in the last 20, 30 years. Russia in particular, I think, went through a period when their mortality rates dropped remarkably, and that was associated with the political changes there and fall in standard of living.
Yeah.
And China's in a very interesting position in terms of how it's changing, in terms of particularly, I think, inequalities. Both societies appear to be developing perhaps the worst aspects of Western societies in terms of moving towards inequalities. Is there just a deficiency in data from these countries, or is there an opportunity to look at them too?
There is an opportunity. I don't include them because I'm looking at the richest 25 per capita, and neither of them quite get into the richest 25. Russia has the same inequality 10 to 10 ratio as we have. We are as unequal as Russia. The big difference is that part of our underlying inequalities have kind of built up since 1066, whereas Russia managed to achieve that all since 1989. When it comes to unequal cities and countries, the only other place anywhere near Europe that has a difference between that we have from London and the rest of the UK is Moscow and the rest of Russia. China is fascinating. The difficulty with China, the good thing about China is that in the last 2 years they've released completely different inequality data to what they released 10 years ago. I think they're now being much more honest, and there is a purge on corruption going on in China. But I wrote things comparing China and India in inequality and saying how wonderful China was compared to India, which has incredible inequality. And then the new Chinese data came out and China turns out not to be so great compared to India anymore. So there is a data issue with China. But there's also this amazing shock in China over what's happened, this 7% GDP growth a year. Infant mortality in urban areas of China is now better than the United States of America. I was in a city very near the Korean border in China last year. The cars were bigger and more expensive than the cars in Oxford. The shock and awe of that change in lifestyle over that period is quite amazing. Whether China manages to hold its income inequality and reduce it, we don't know. But currently, just to leave you on a good message, I did a book last year called The Equality Effect. The majority of countries in the rich world are seeing inequality falling, and that includes China, which now just about qualifies to be in the rich world. So currently we are seeing falls. We don't know if those falls are going to continue, but it's possible that we're at a worldwide maxima for inequality, and that the issue has become seen as so important that things are actually going to steadily change. The last time that happened was 1913, and it partly happened because of the First World War. So if it was to happen without a world war, that would be truly miraculous. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Danny. That was fantastic. I'll hand over now to Peter Diggle, who's chairing our statistical session. Thank you.